Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Today, we're going to find out why the Mediterranean diet is linked to reduced brain shrinkage, especially as we grow older. This is from the Alzheimer's Research Institute in the United Kingdom, an article published in the Privy Journal of Neurology. We have a lot more on health and healing, and then we have a guest in the second part of our program. She is Carrie Gillam, G-I-L-L-A-M, and we're going to talk about Bayer Monsanto, covert operations to protect its products and silence and attack its opponents. So anyone and everyone, it would seem, that opposed GMOs, especially glyphosate, and its poisoning of people and the environment, you're fair game. And so here is an environmental and agricultural journalist, an award-winning investigative reporter, who's been traveling around the nation for years to observe and report on the state of America's food systems, our farming, and meeting with U.S. regulators and lawmakers, scientists, corporate officials. And she is the research director at the U.S. Right to Know, a nonprofit consumer organization devoted to exposing the truth about industrial agriculture and the threats of pesticides and GMOs and exposing big agriculture's corruption. Earlier, Carrie was a Reuters journalist for 17 years, and she's been invited by the European Parliament to address a council about Monsanto and Roundup when the European Union deliberated on whether or not to ban Monsanto's glyphosate herbicide. She's written a book called Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. And the book received the Rachel Carson Environmental Book Award and exposes the role of corporate influence over American agriculture and federal officials and politicians. Her website is Carrie Gillam, G-I-L-L-A-M.com. I give you this bio now because I'm going to go right into it when she's on board. Also today, because we have so much to share, I'm going to start off our audio clips a little later with why students don't want free speech on campus anymore. Now, of course, that's not all students in all campuses, but it's a growing trend where everyone seems to be hypersensitive. I wish they'd have watched the Golden Globe Awards, at only the introduction, his commentary, and he offended all of Hollywood, which is a good thing because these virtue-signaling idiots need someone to stand up and tell them, stop telling us how we should live our lives, and as he said, you're completely disconnected from the real world. In fact, Jesse, if you can get a clip of his opening monologue of 8 minutes, I'd like to play it for the audience. I think they'd find it important. He's done this for 5 years. This will be his last year, he said. But rare upon rarity, someone is that brutally honest to a group of the most famous celebrities in America. Some were laughing. Tom Hanks and others were not. I listened. I just laughed. I thought it was hilarious. And that's the way you would expect it. Lenny Bruce or Don Rinkles or Robin Williams and all the other, Richard Pryor, all the other comedians who were not afraid to laugh at us based upon our foibles and stupidity. Today, a lot of comedians will not go on college campuses because there's always going to be someone who takes issue with something and they just don't believe it's worth it. Wow, when you can't laugh at yourself, how bad is that? But you can watch this one by going to youtube.com/PRNFM, youtube.com/PRNFM. And I'm saving two other clips for tonight. I just want to mention this. Tonight is going to be a really, really powerful program. I'm going to challenge PBS. Specifically, their investigative reporting program. It was sent to me by a listener. I've watched it, and it's a propaganda piece supporting the White Helmets and the founder of the White Helmets and how the people challenging this are just conspiratorial. So we're going to play part of that clip, but But then we're going to do something that NBC, CBS, CNN, the New York Times, no one else has done. We're going to bring on real journalists who have been in the war zone in Syria, for example, and show you the truth about the white helmets, show you that little cute kid that has all the, you know, the battle of war blood on him, and it was all staged. You're going to hear from the kid and his father. He's in four different battle scenes. They move him around the country, figuring nobody's paying attention, certainly not the American media. If we find the clip, we'll also include the clip that you can watch, by the way, that shows you an empty room with a camera shooting out the window at a building, and no one's there for a long period of time. Then suddenly there's activity, and then they say start filming, and then you see an explosion. And then we're told that that's an explosion, you know, in the middle of a battle zone, and there's, you know, bullets flying. None of that was true, because then you see someone take the camera and they go around to the building and it's a ditch, a drain ditch, and an oil pipe has burst and people by the hundreds are out there scooping up the free oil, and then someone lit that, and so it looked from the other side how the camera was positioned that they're in the middle of a battle zone. It was all a fraud, and you see it. So we're going to show you the truth about the white helmets and how everybody, including the Academy Committee, gave it an Academy Award for a short documentary. Amy Goodman had them on her program. Of course, we do actual investigative journalism. We would never have them on unless it was to debate them. So we're going to do a blistering challenge to PBS and its lack of honest reporting. Now, they're smart. They're fully capable of doing a completely honest job, and I'm sure on many occasions do so without bias. This, they either didn't do their homework, or they knew the truth and chose to not engage it for whatever their motive may be. You'll see the full truth, and it's going to be more than an hour. Now, I realize a lot of you, especially on our sister station, BAI New York, you don't have access to the internet or you're not good with the internet. Fine. I'll play this segment, tonight's Progressive Commentary Hour, on tomorrow's noon BAI, because this is the kind of information, especially at this time, that you need to know. Also, today we will do a clip from Authentic Broadcasting over in RT, where there's a panel of at least seven good reporters, Scott Ritter, the former Iran inspector on weapons of mass destruction. There's Ron Paul, where they're talking about what really is behind our posturing, the attack, and the consequences. This is information completely unlike anything that the mainstream or alternative media has produced up to this point. This is the measured, insightful, well thought through truth. So you won't want to miss that. That'll be today right after Health and Healing. So that's our program. We have a lot to share. And I want to make sure people tune in tonight. Go to 7 o'clock PRN.fm for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Now we begin with the latest on health. A new study led by researchers from Scotland has found that older people, meaning over the age of 40, who ate a Mediterranean-style diet, we all know what that is, lots of vegetables and whole grains and nuts and seeds and beans and legume, and they also include fish in the Mediterranean diet, they experienced less brain shrinkage than those who ate other types of food. And this is published in the current issue of Neurology. Why is this important? Well, a little classroom on the air. Your brain begins to reduce in size after early adulthood, generally by your mid-20s, as we naturally start to lose nerve cells and the connections between them. This shrinking accelerates as people reach older age and can result in some increased difficulty with certain aspects of memory and thinking. This natural loss of nerve cells is different to the much quicker, more severe brain shrinkage that is caused by diseases like Alzheimer's. So that's why it's important in your lifestyle to do anything that allows that shrinkage to be lessened. So when your diet is avoid of meat and dairy products and refined carbohydrates and sugars and rich in vegetables and legumes and fruits and nuts and seeds, herbs, then you're going to have less shrinkage. So that's the takeaway message. From the University of Southern Denmark comes this study. It's about mindfulness. And it's been shown, according to the University of Southern Denmark, that mindfulness has been shown to reduce negative emotions in both healthy individuals as well as patients with psychological problems. And studies have also shown that mindfulness is effective for treating clinical emotional problems like anxiety and depression and stress and trauma-related disorders. And the biological mechanisms that underlie these positive effects on emotional functioning, most people are not aware of, most scientists are not aware of. But brain imaging studies have shown that mindfulness training is associated with changes in regions of the brain previously known to be involved in the capacity of the brain to learn and making better choices. However, the actual effect of mindfulness training on learning has never been demonstrated. In any case, if you want to be a person that makes it easier to focus, easier, more reliable to remember, a better memory, mindfulness meditation can help do that. Also, there's a first-of-its-kind clinical study initiated to investigate the potential benefits of nicotinamide riboside, that's the very popular supplement right now, combined with exercise in older adults with hypertension. This is from Florida, University of Florida. And NAD is what it's called. And there's lots of studies on NAD. And this is one from the National Institute on Aging. And they took a look to see if this NAD enhanced the effects of exercise therapy as you get older with hypertension, and it did. So that's terrific. Remember, NAD declines as you age, but it's a critical coenzyme for cellular energy production and mitochondrial function, both important components of healthy human aging. When you age, you reduce your mitochondria. That's a bad thing. And you have less cellular energy. That's a bad thing. And you have less energy in the heart and brain. That's a terrible thing. So you need to up that mitochondria energy and create more adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. And this is one of the things that helped. By the way, pycnogenol does this, and very well doing it is L-carnitine and coenzyme Q10. Now, another study from the University of Maryland, also looking at NAD, shows it could play a role in prevention of peripheral neuropathy. And that's epidemic levels in the United States because diabetes invokes a maladaptation in glucose and lipid energy metabolism in adult sensory neurons and axons and Schwann cells. So over the age of 40, you really should have NAD in your body because you're diminishing it and it makes a difference. From University College London, an article published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology says, if you want to turn back time, try running a marathon. That's right. The new year means it's time to set resolutions, and I'm going to be doing the New York City Marathon this year, and I haven't done one in about 10 years. And so I did multiple every year for decades, and then one day I just lost interest in it. So I went to shorter races, but now I'm going to do it as a celebration, and I'm going to do it starting in training in April after the next retreat in anti-aging clinical study, which we're reproducing, by the way. The results are in, and they're just spectacular. I just got the full results this morning, and I can tell you, I've never seen a study anywhere in the history of science that shows in a short 60-day period, extended for another 30 to 90 days, all the changes that you could do objective clinical changes in the DNA and the cells through blood workup and through the protocols that were implemented. The scientific group that's looking at all this was sent some very nice letters, but now I got to duplicate it again, which, as they said, is the gold standard. If you do it twice and someone else is supervising it the second time, you're there to address any issue that comes up, but they're guiding the whole study, then you've met all the criteria. Also, we're doing this, filming it in real time all over the world, so their group of scientists, and they have over 56,000 anti-aging scientists around the world, they'll be able to monitor it and ask questions in real time every day. So I'll be spending a lot of time answering scientists' questions all over the world, but it'll be monitored by thousands, potentially thousands of eyes are going to be on what we're doing, which is good, because it makes it a whole lot more challenging for the skeptics or the AMA or for the pharmaceutical companies to try to undermine it, which you can bet anything they're going to try to do. So, yeah, we're very familiar with running. In fact, one of the people that just finished could only do 2 miles at a 22-minute, 7-second pace per mile when she started. Her last day, because I was there timing her, she did 26.3 miles, a full marathon, with no great effort at all. I mean, phenomenal results. Just a quick heads up, when I'm not the one who screens anybody, but for those who are interested in coming to the 60-day on campus, you've got to be there for 60 days on campus and 30 days follow-up at home, you can call Luann Panessi, and she is the one you got to speak with. She sees whether or not this is right for you. You cannot have any life-threatening illnesses. That is an exclusion. We can help you in other ways if you have one of those, but we can't be giving a protocol to someone who is near death, because then the whole protocol is going to be working to save your life instead of changing your DNA. So there's different protocols. The protocols I would give for someone who has terminal cancer or congestive heart failure are different than these protocols. I can't mix them for this study. We're certainly helping people with other conditions. We're going to be doing a retreat as a fundraiser sometime in April for a week to 2 weeks. But this starts March 22nd and goes for 60 days. You can call Luann, 903-881-7008, 903-881-7008, if you want to be part of this study, because part one is done. It's in the history books. We did it. We did what science has not been able to do. They're studying petri dishes. They're studying stem cells. They're studying what can be the easiest thing for people to do. Like, there's a group of scientists that went down to Colombia. They're charging people $1 million for a single injection of what they think is going to work and reverse their aging of their tissues. I haven't seen any clinical studies. I haven't seen any proof of it at all. And it'd be interesting seeing how many people go down, but to lay out $1 million for a single injection? Wow. Why Colombia? Well, because if they did that in the United States, the FDA would be all over them. They all want to, everybody involved, hundreds of thousands of people are involved in this, by the way. This is the future, anti-aging. But they're all looking for that golden ring, the Nobel Prize, a patentable product, a drug. And I'm saying that's the wrong approach. No drugs, no medical intervention. It's all in the lifestyle. So that's that. Anyhow, that's the study from University College London. Run. Run long distance. Helps you with your aging. Also from George Washington University comes a study about processed foods are highly correlated with obesity epidemic in the United States. And what they're saying is this, and it just is common sense. As food consumed in the United States becomes more and more processed, obesity is becoming more prevalent. Well, how much more prevalent is it? It's 50% of the entire population right now is obesity. By the way, that's not overweight. Overweight's even more. About 75% of Americans are overweight And amongst those are 50% are obese. You're just going to live a shorter life and you're going to be miserable. And this was published in Current Treatment Options in Gastroenterology. It's that sugar, sweetened beverages, potato chips, pretzels, pizzas. Yeah. And that the emulsifiers and the food additives and the gums. And that all increases obesity, particularly in women. So one more reason why to go more natural. And good news from Cashon University of Medicine, the apoptotic and anti-cancer effects of cinnamon. Yeah, cinnamon, C-I-N-N-A-M-O-N. Now, we know the cancer rates are on the rise, and researchers are anxious to find possible alternative and herbal remedies to prevent and treat cancer. And conventional cancer treatments, including chemotherapy and radiation, both of which work to kill cancerous cells or arrest cancer cell growth, but also have numerous negative side effects, including creating cancer. However, a recent study published in the European Journal of Medical Chemistry concluded that eugenol, E-U-G-E-N-O-L, and a chemical which is cinnamaldehyde, two of the active ingredients in cinnamon, have powerful apoptotic properties that could be used to fight the growth and regeneration of cancer cells. So, cinnamon helps both with Alzheimer's, it helps with Parkinson's disease, now it helps with cancer. And cinnamon also, in a separate study from Algarth Muslim University in India, shows that it has potential for managing PCOS. This was published in the Journal of Herbal Medicine. And by the way, PCOS is a complex syndrome that affects about 15% of women of reproductive age. And there's not a lot of standard therapy that really does anything for it. This was a randomized, single-blinded study that made a huge difference in the condition. So, and by the way, it stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome. So it made a difference. And resveratrol shows promise against colitis. That's from the University of South Carolina. So that's another good study. So this is the latest. No, one more. University of British Columbia. Orange peel extract boosts the best anti-inflammatory properties. Yeah. Obtaining dried citrus peel from mandarins or tangerines can provide potentially superior benefit in nutraceuticals and functional foods compared to conventional sources. So, good. One more piece of information that helps us. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, I'm looking at the clock. So, Jesse, let's go directly to... Let's go directly to the real story behind the U.S. attack on Iran, because this is completely diametrically opposite of what everyone else in the media is telling the public. So at least they have a counterbalance to choose which, if either, they want to believe.
Iranian official. As we all collectively hold our breaths, it seems the question to be asked is now, what is next? Via satellite, we also have Scott Ritter, weapons inspector, very much known for his expertise in this particular region, who's going to be joining us as well. You see on the screen there as well from Tehran live is Mohammed Marandi, the University of Tehran professor, who's going to give us his perspective. And here on the set, we have with us Christy I, our Boom Bus host, to tell us what's going on with the markets as a result of this. Michelle Greenstein, who is taking us through what the global reactions are from all over the world. And then Max Blumenthal, the editor of The Gray Zone, is joining us here as well. And Jim Jatras, who is a former State Department official. All right, let's get started with Mohammad Mirandi. He's at the University of Tehran. He has been following this story very carefully, as all of his countrymen are. Professor Mirandi, thank you, sir, for taking time to join us. Let's start with this. What I think is maybe the most important question to ask you, since it's what we have been hearing here. The U.S. position from the left, from the right, from the media, is that Qasem Soleimani was a terrorist responsible for the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of Americans. How would you describe him?
Well, Iranians see him as a hero. He not only was he a war hero during the invasion of Saddam Hussein, where the United States and the Europeans gave Saddam Hussein everything, including chemical weapons, and he was a key commander during that war, a volunteer. But also, after the United States began supporting extremist groups with the Saudis and Qatar and Turkey and Syria, and after tens of thousands of foreign fighters were brought into the country, in 2013, he began to get involved to prevent the capital, Damascus, from falling into the hands of ISIS and other such groups like al-Qaeda. And they began to push these groups back there. And also in Iraq, when ISIS spilled over into that country, the Americans had destroyed Iraq because of the wars, the sanctions, and, of course, the invasion. It was a broken country, and there was no real resistance in the face of ISIS. So right when Baghdad, the capital, was about to fall, he went to the capital and personally took charge of the defense of the capital, and ISIS forces reached the outskirts of that city. So he and the Iraqi commander, who was also murdered by the Americans, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, they were the two key figures, or two of the key figures, that saved Iraq and pushed ISIS back.
Let me ask you—
Iranians believe that if it wasn't for him, the capitals of Iraq and Syria would have been held.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a second question that we're hearing here in the United States. Earlier today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo came out and essentially said that the only reason we did this was to avert an imminent attack against the United States by your country, although when he was asked to be specific, he had no specifics. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, the United States government behaves with arrogance. They are judge, jury, and prosecutor, on the one hand. Second of all, Pompeo himself, just a few months ago, said that when in the CIA, we were taught to lie, to cheat, and to steal. And that's what the United States did when they invaded Iraq in the first place. They fabricated intelligence about weapons of mass destruction and cooperation between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and justified their war and their destruction of the country. But also, in addition to that, when the Americans wanted to strike the Iraqi target a couple of days ago, and they wanted to kill the 30 young men who were on the Syrian border fighting ISIS, American Secretary of Defense called the Iraqi Prime Minister. The Prime Minister told him not to carry out the attacks. He was ignored. But also, the Prime Minister told him to provide the Iraqis with the intelligence that they have, and he refused. Why? Well, part of it is arrogance, and part of it is that there was no intelligence. So the United States, whenever they need to justify something, the government, they'll say something, and the media will mimic whatever the State Department, the White House, or the Pentagon says.
Final question to you. Final question to you regarding the situation right now there in Iran. We have been seeing pictures. In fact, I don't know if, Peter, we might be able to put some of those videos up of these crowds that have been amassing around Tehran today, apparently in mourning for the general's death. The question is this, do you believe, going to unify Iran? Especially based on the fact that last time I talked to you, we were talking about the fact that people in Iran were essentially angry because of the economy there, and now they're having protests against the United States.
Well, the Iranians were very angry, and I think they continue to be angry with the administration because of their the way in which they increased the price of fuel. But General Soleimani has always been a very popular figure in Iran throughout this period, and even Western polls admit that. But it has united the country, and there are crowds and gatherings across the country, and I think the funeral the day after tomorrow will be enormous. But also, tomorrow there will be a funeral in Iraq, and he will be, his body will be taken to a couple of the cities in the south of Iraq. And it's predicted that there will be huge crowds in Iraq, both for him and for Abdul Mahdi al-Muhandis, the Iraqi commander that the Americans assassinated. And in fact, the Americans carried out an act of war on both Iraq and Iran. But I think that when the people see the crowds tomorrow, they'll discover that the narrative created by the United States, the Saudis and the Emiratis, that the Iraqi people hate Iran, I think that narrative will become will suffer a great deal, and they will see how Iraqis feel about General Soleimani and his role in saving their country.
Mohammed Mirandi, Professor, our thanks to you, sir, for taking time to share your perspective there from Tehran. Thank you, sir. We're going to be joined now by our panel. This whole notion that suddenly what the United States has done may actually be a unifying factor for the people of Iran is one that we probably should take a good look at. Scott Ritter, I'm going to bring you in for this. Do you think the, as you like to say in your field, the blowback or the backfire here will be the fact that we're actually going to coalesce some forces in that region, specifically inside Iran and maybe beyond its borders as well?
Well, first of all, let's be straight. There was never a problem inside Iran, not one worthy of mentioning in this context. The Iranian government is firmly in charge. There is some discontent about the economy, but it never rose to the level that threatened the viability of the Iranian government. So the notion that the death of General Soleimani is somehow going to coalesce the Iranian government is ludicrous. They were already coalesced. They already were unified in their position against the American posture in the Middle East. The real danger here is that the United States probably tipped the balance in the Iraqi parliament to vote for legislation that kicks the Americans out of Iraq. Now, this has been a long time goal of the Iranian government to get the United States military out of Iraq. And thanks to President Trump, we probably just facilitated that happening. The Iraqi government is very angry. The Iraqi parliament is poised to make a vote, and that vote will probably be for America to leave Iraq.
Let's go to Jim Jatras, former State Department diplomat here. That's an interesting point that he makes. You want to follow up on that?
Yeah. The first question, I think Scott is exactly right, and the next question that occurs to me is, when they do vote for us to leave Iraq, will we actually leave? Or will we insist on staying in basically it would be a resumed occupation role without even the fig leaf of having the permission of the host government to have our forces there? I was listening to, on some of the other, standard networks where congressmen were being asked about this, and they were giving a kind of, that sort of remains to be seen, whether we would actually leave if they vote us out.
Let's talk about what this actually was. Few people are actually using the word, but I think some are. An assassination, a hit. Is this our new foreign policy? Max Blumenthal?
This reminds me distinctly of Israel's mode of operation, particularly in the Gaza Strip. It reminds me of what they've done since the Second Intifada, when they dropped a 2,000-pound bomb on a civilian apartment block to kill Salah Shahada, then the commander of the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. But they're not dealing with a local militant group like Al-Qassam or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They're dealing with a regional power, and Iran is going to do something to demonstrate just that back to the U.S. I don't think that Donald Trump realizes what he's just done.
Michelle Greenstein, you've been working on the reaction that we're seeing from all over the world. What is the reaction from some of the big countries, you know, Russia, China, you know, different countries all over the world, Middle East?
The international reaction is pretty much what you'd expect. We have Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif calling this an act of international terrorism and also an extremely dangerous and foolish escalation. We also have the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, warning that this is going to result in severe revenge from the Iranian side. Now, let's talk about the Iraqi reaction, because after all, this happened on Iraqi soil. We have the Prime Minister, Adel Abdul Mahdi, saying that this might spark a devastating war, which I would say is pretty significant because, of course, we're talking about a post-2003 Iraqi administration. Now, in terms of the broader global community, we have both the Chinese and Russian foreign ministries warning not to increase tensions, saying that all parties should exercise restraint. But let's also talk about the Israeli reaction, because we also had Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who actually spoke with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just hours before the assassination, praised the strike and claiming that it was an act of self-defense. Take a listen.
Just as Israel has the right of self-defense, the United States has exactly the same right. Qasem Soleimani is responsible for the death of American citizens and many other innocent people. He was planning more such attacks. President Trump deserves all the credit for acting swiftly, forcefully, decisively.
So you have Israel kind of towing the Washington line, which is that this is an act of self-defense. But then you had the United
States. Or is it vice versa?
Right. I mean, that's the big question, isn't it? But then you also have the United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings calling that claim into question. Take a listen.
Okay.
Under international law, self-defense, to be lawful, will need to be invoked in situations where there is an imminent attack against the interest or the territory, in this case of the United States. At this point in time, the United States has not thus far provided any information suggesting that there was an imminent attack.
Now, there's just one more reaction, if you want to call it, that I want to take a look at, and that's of the major U.S. weapons contractors. We had companies like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, all seeing their stock, interestingly enough, take a rise after this assassination.
That's interesting. In fact, let's do this. Let's bring in Christy Eye. She's our financial expert here at RT America, and we use her a lot on the Rick Sanchez Show. You know, you always have to ask yourself in these situations, right, who stands to gain? Who stands to gain?
Exactly, and I'm so happy you brought that up, because let's take a look at this heat map that we have here showing the current, what the state of the current U.S. equities market looks like in the past 24 hours. So if you look at it, global equities dropped around the world, and you see this is like a sea of red with most of the majors, such as tech and healthcare, all falling. But the big points of standout green are obviously in oil, energy and utilities, consumer staples, which is a very safe stock, and that light green up on the upper right-hand corner, which is all defense stock. Defense, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, all the defense contractors, as well as manufacturers who are benefiting from this.
That's amazing. It's almost like you could almost predict the pattern immediately after you saw this, right?
Exactly. And this shows that there's a tremendous risk-off movement in the market because, remember, this is only the second trading day of 2020. So most of the portfolio managers, they positioned yesterday in preparing for this enormous trading rally that they've been all running into, only to have the entire global equities market fall out from under them. So now you see a massive repositioning, and they're all moving into safety assets and currencies such as the Swiss franc, the Japanese yen, the Hong Kong dollar, as well as cryptocurrencies, which are all up over 5 and 10% today.
Scott Ritter, Max Blumenthal, you guys write and think about this all the time. What are you thinking when you see suddenly people are becoming multimillionaires overnight as a result of this? Max, why don't you get started, then we'll go to Scott.
I actually don't see a lot of strategic advantage here from a national security perspective. What we're looking at here is an extreme wing of the national security state, which has aligned itself tightly with the axis of extremism represented by Israel, particularly its Likud party and Netanyahu, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia. And this axis is extremely upset that Qasem Soleimani managed to mobilize the Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization units, and destroy ISIS, which was, in many ways, a proxy force that supported their interests of destabilizing the Middle East using Wahhabi, Salafi, jihadi proxies. And so this is, in many ways, revenge, but it's also imperial hubris, because Soleimani not only is one of the most popular figures in Iran, people are in the streets crying because he's been killed. This is seen as an attack on all Shia people in the Middle East. And the U.S. doesn't know, I don't think they understand, what they have just triggered.
Scott Ritter, I want to bring you in on this conversation. What are you thinking about this hit? How would you describe it to the American people so they can better understand it?
An absolute, unmitigated disaster of a scale of which they are unable to comprehend at this point in time, because right now we don't see a cost. I mean, we're used to this. We're used to seeing American forces deployed to the Middle East. Yeah. We're used to seeing American drones take out high-value targets. But what we've never done is felt the price, has paid the consequences. And, you know, the other thing is we have everybody standing by for an immediate attack. That isn't going to happen. The Iranians are far smarter than this. The last thing they want is a toe-to-toe fight. This is going to be a long, drawn-out strategic defeat of the United States in the Middle East, beginning in Iraq, going into Syria, and we're going to see a retrograde of American power and influence in the region like we haven't ever seen before. It's a defeat of enormous proportions, and there will be economic consequences, geopolitical consequences, and this is probably the least thought out military action undertaken by an American president in modern history.
Could this thing lead to war, and if it does, do we win? Jim Jatras.
In terms of inflicting a lot of damage on the Iranians, yes, of course we could win in that sense. Mm-hmm. Will we achieve any strategic objectives? I don't think so, and I don't think we understand.
I mean a war. I mean a mano a mano. Our troops, their troops. Can we win that war?
We can win in the sense we can inflict a lot of damage on the Iranians. Can we achieve anything where we actually have some objective that we've met? I don't think so.
Scott, do you quickly, Scott, before I go, because we have a special guest standing by. What would your answer to that question be if somebody asked you? Could we win a war against Iran?
Look, the new Marine Corps Commandant answered that question when he put out his mission statement. He said, we can no longer count on maritime amphibious forces being able to close with an enemy shore and debarking troops because they have standoff weapons that will sink our ships before they get close. The Iranians have those standoff weapons. This will, if we go to war, yeah, we'll inflict damage, but guess what? They will, too.
Joining us now, the president of the Ron Paul Institute and the Liberty Institute.
I wanted to share that with you because you're not hearing this dialogue in the mainstream media. And these are people who are experienced, including Max Blumenthal, award-winning journalist, and one of the founders of the Gray Zone, Scott Ritter, and former U.S. diplomat Jim Jatras, and NRS correspondent Michelle Greenstein. So, yes, in the initial sense, people will say, great, we got this killer, this terrorist. Do you remember 6 years ago, ISIS was rolling through Syria and rolling through Iraq? Who stopped him? It wasn't the United States. We were the ones supporting ISIS, Al-Nusra and Al-Qaeda, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and also Israel. So now that opens it up for ISIS to reemerge, but it also means that the parliament now voted yesterday in Iraq, get rid of American forces. That means that whatever position, geopolitical position we had, it's gone. Now, we're not going to leave. We have dozens of military bases. Bagram's the biggest, one of the biggest in the world. And we have the largest embassy in the world, 7,000 employees minimally. So now we're going to be looked upon as a conquering, occupying foreign entity. So this was stupid. Anyhow, as things occur, we will bring you up to date on it. Let's now go over and say hello to our guest. And I gave you her detailed biography earlier in the program, Carrie Gillam, G-I-L-L-A-M. Nice to have you with us today, Carrie.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me.
Carrie, in the aftermath of the court rulings against Monsanto's glyphosate and about 20,000 additional pending suits, I've been told as high as 47,000, but let's go more conservative. The Trump administration is siding, not surprisingly, with agricultural industry representatives. In August, the White House stated it would not approve cancer warning labels on Roundup, the most popular commercial pesticide on the market. Then last month, the EPA and Trump stacked Justice Department supported Bayer, arguing that the verdict against Roundup should be overturned. The Justice Department even stated it would be illegal if Bayer were to post warning labels on the bottles. The company continues to argue that Roundup poses no cancer risks. We've covered the health risks of glyphosate on this program many times in the past. What interests me now are the motivations and powerful influences being exerted on our government to come to the defense of Bayer Monsanto, despite the overwhelming scientific evidence, including Monsanto's own inner department scientific evidence that was hidden from the public until it was received under Freedom of Information Act, which showed all forms of cancer, and they knew this. So can you speak on the power that the big agri lobby and its allies has on the federal government and the judiciary, and who are the main lobbying forces, despite the fact that since the Clinton administration, many of our federal agencies, particularly the FDA and the USDA, have been stacked with former Monsanto employees and associates? And does the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, have much of a role on the Trump administration's agricultural decisions? The forum is yours.
That's a lot to unravel, isn't it? Yes, I mean, this Roundup litigation is fascinating, I think, on many fronts. And you're right, there are now about 47,000 or 42,700 plaintiffs who are lined up suing Monsanto and thus Monsanto's new owner, Bayer, the German company. And they're all alleging that exposure to these glyphosate-based herbicides like Roundup and Ranger Pro caused the plaintiffs to develop non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And there are different forms, of course, of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And that Monsanto knew about it and failed to warn them, failed to identify the risk on the label and give them adequate and accurate information about the risks that they were facing. And as you know, there have been three trials, three verdicts so far. This really interesting development that you alluded to with the Justice Department coming in and making a filing on December 20th, an amicus brief essentially supporting Monsanto and Bayer in their appeal of this federal verdict that came down last spring. And what they're essentially saying, I mean, if the court would uphold this, it could wipe out a lot of tort litigation, essentially. They're basically saying that this law, FIFRA, the Federal Fungicide, Insecticide, and Rodenticide Act, preempts, any sort of claims. If the EPA says it's fine, you know, it's fine, and you can't challenge it. It's basically what they're saying. Now, the lower court, the federal judge in the trial already dismissed that claim. Monsanto's raised this before, so what the EPA is raising is not necessarily new. And there's already case law precedent and referred to as the Bates decision that favors plaintiffs in this. But, you know, you never know what the appellate court is going to decide. And as we do know, Trump has been appointing a lot of new judges. There are, I think, 9 new federal judges appointed to the Ninth Circuit where this appeal is being heard. So you really don't know, you know, what's going to happen, but it definitely will be a very important ruling for tort actions, not just for Monsanto, but for other people who might be injured by pesticides and chemicals that are regulated by EPA and other federal agencies. So, you know, it's really an important thing to watch. But it harkens back to a document that we reported on, I reported on back in May. Monsanto had sent a consultant to Washington, D.C. in 2018 to find out the mood of the Trump administration and how solidly they were going to support Monsanto. And this consultant came back and said, you know, we've talked with domestic policy advisor at the White House, and they have said, quote, we have Monsanto's back on pesticide regulation. We're going to go toe-to-toe on any disputes they may have. So, you know, this shows you right there, the White House is doubling down and going to protect Monsanto, protect big business. It seems they're prioritizing corporate interests definitely above public health and public interest.
Carrie, thank you. I appreciate that answer. But I want to turn to the main topic, which is Bayer and Monsanto and other big agricultural giants' covert surveillance and disinformation campaigns to silence critics. And with the release of the Monsanto papers, we learned that Monsanto operated Fusion Center. A Fusion Center is basically an operation to gather resources and information to detect and target criminals and terrorists. And this is why Monsanto perceives journalists like yourself and scientists who speak out against pesticides and GMO dangers or research them, like Dr. Seralini in France, comes to mind, environmental activists such as Neil Young, the rock artist, who was targeted by Monsanto, and even concerned parents such as the organization Moms Across America. Monsanto's Fusion Center literally gathered intelligence information on hundreds of people, myself included, because I had the most popular documentary, Seeds of Death, just on YouTube alone had over 1.5 million views. And then it was aired over 85 times on Colorado Public Television. So for those of us who've been targeted by a Fusion Center so that we are the enemies, it does not portend well for an open democracy. Your thoughts, please.
No, I totally agree with you. And you're right. When you see documents, as I have, as you have, and others, where a very big, powerful company like this is targeting an individual, targeting you personally, with a whole array of resources. You know, what they were doing, they were involving consulting companies, and you're right, setting up what they refer to as a fusion center and engaging third parties and different strategies to try to sort of control and manipulate Google search engine optimization, for instance, so that people who are searching for information about me or about my work or about you or about different issues are going to get directed to pro-industry, pro-Monsanto messaging. That's very definitely what we see in these documents that have come to light. They had a whole spreadsheet, put together with different line items set to attack me when my book came out in 2017, for instance. And as you said, they talk about sort of spying on this folk singer Neil Young and how they could neutralize his messaging against the industry. And yeah, I was just looking at new documents that have come out in the last few weeks about this French scientist Seralini and how to discredit him, how to get his science retracted, his scientific papers. And very importantly, what they try to do is they make it look like it's not coming from the company. They try to make it look like it's coming from independent third parties and professors or academics or regulators or others. And it's really alarming. And they're using social media to amplify their messaging. They're using front groups. They're funneling money to all these different academics and organizations secretly to get them, to promote this messaging. And it's really, it's a deceitful practice, but it was, put in play in the tobacco industry, decades ago. And they're just perfecting it as time goes on.
So it becomes circular. Google, then, which is pro-Monsanto, and and bear, they send you over to Wikipedia, Wikipedia run by a group of skeptics on anything involving environment or health. They're pro-establishment. And so then a media person would give an opportunity to interview you. They Google you, see that there's something negative there or some other publication. And then they think, well, we'll pass on her. She's too controversial, or there's something in her work that is not accurate and we don't want to be embarrassed. So they have that. And Cheney did it with the weapons of mass destruction. He was creating with a cherry-picked group of CIA operatives out of Scooter Libby, his chief of staff's office, creating the intelligence and then feeding it to Judith Miller. Judith Miller then was reporting, and Cheney said, well, look, even in the New York Times they're saying that there's this information about weapons of mass destruction. Wikipedia and Bear has done the same thing.
Yes, very definitely. And when you talk about it, like, you know, people who aren't familiar might be skeptical and say, gosh, it sounds like you're just a conspiracy nut, you know, and this sounds too crazy to be true. And I probably felt that way myself years ago, but I've seen far too many documents proving that this is what has been going on. And there are consulting companies in Europe and in the U.S. and around the company that the world that this is what they do. You know, they create disinformation. They create doubt to benefit companies and to discredit the truth tellers, journalists and scientists and broadcasters and people who are simply trying to report facts and information. You know, it's scary. It's very scary, and it threatens, you know, democracy. It threatens the free press. People should be very concerned about it.
We are, and that's why we had you on. You're a courageous person. You were with Reuters for a long time. You're a highly respected journalist. Cheryl Atkinson at CBS, a highly respected journalist. But the moment they touch its topic that industry is threatened by their exposure, they go on the attack. And you ought to read the biography on Cheryl Atkinson. We've done several defense programs and articles on her on Wikipedia, and we've gone after Wikipedia. I hope people read your book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. The website is Carrie, C-A-R-E-Y, Gilliam, G-I-L-L-A-M.com. Carrie, thank you for being on, and we wish you only the best.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Gary Nall, and we're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and listen tonight, 7 p.m. Again, we need, and our sister station BAI is one of the few programs and stations that will air information that challenges the orthodox or established points of view. And this is what we need to know, because they have the entire establishment from top to bottom, including PBS, and that's who we're taking on tonight, have been behind supporting misinformation, disinformation, whether intentionally or not. And we want to set the record straight. And this is an important issue. So listen in 7 p.m. PRN.FM or tomorrow on BAI at noon. Have a nice day.
Well, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm gonna go. I'm gonna pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. Everybody in the little neighborhood is dressing up to be there too. And we're gonna have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies, who cares what picture you see?
Hi, I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to introduce you to a very important product that I've created. It's called Green Stuff. Green Stuff is based upon the concept that a lot of people are not eating, ideally, all of the different vegetables they should each day, especially your dark green vegetables. So what I've done is I've taken all those vegetables, you'll see them here in this basket, parsley and celery and cabbage. A lot of your cruciferous vegetables are here also, and asparagus. And I've put them all together, juiced them, and then dry them without heat, so it's about 88 degrees. So each day, when you have the teaspoon, a single serving, and you put it into a cup of any beverage you want, it could be apple juice, water, and you drink that down, your whole body is given the benefit of the finest greens that I can find, making small batches of this wonderfully powerful chlorophyll-rich drink, Green Stuff. And we have it on special sale for all of our listeners. Please look at the number, and you can order at that number right there on your screen. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Because the reality is, how often are you going to be eating cabbage, broccoli, radish, broccoli sprouts, collard greens, apples, and carrots, oat beta-glucan, barley and kale, spinach? It's all here. So you don't have to do it. So this is your insurance for good health. Eat a good diet. Yes, ideally a plant-based diet. Exercise every day. Take appropriate supplements. De-stress. And then the final insurance for health, one serving of Green Stuff every day. You'll enjoy it.